Oh, hello.
Hey,
Hi.
how are you? Good to see you.
Hello, hello. Very good to see you. I just want to point out, I just said that this is a first for the ICDT to have not only the Deputy Secretary General, but also participants from non-European countries like China, Japan. I wanted to say Russia, but Russia is a European country, so but still deserves a special mentioning. And as a special surprise for you, we have somebody from the Belarusian opposition as well. So Mr. Sannikov, who I've known for I don't know how many years, there is only, so let us start with these many friends. There are very few advantages of age. One of them is that you get less migraine when you are aging. But the other one is that you have a lot of friends. And I'm very happy and very proud to see so many good friends here from all over the world. One of them is Mircea Joana, who at this point is the Deputy Secretary General of the North Atlantic Alliance. He is not so very old, but his distinguished career is very long, so I will not enumerate all the positions that he has been in. I just want to tell you one very interesting moment in my life when Romania was in the chair of the OSCE. It was 97, or I guess. Mircea was the foreign minister, of course, of Romania, and he invited me to join the Romanian chairmanship team. So there was a Hungarian diplomat in the Romanian team, which is interesting. It was a very interesting idea, but I think it worked well, did it, Mircea? So so it's a little bit more much more than professional relationship. It's a friendship with a unique person, and therefore we are very honored and very happy to have you here, Mircea. And everybody will hopefully excuse me, you included, that I will not call you Deputy Secretary General or Your Excellency or whatever, but first name. I think all of you will understand it, and many of you will call him on first name. The purpose of this, and I always quote a friend of mine who used to be the president of the Central European University, still in Budapest that time, and he said that the role of the president is like a door that presidents open and close, which means I open and don't talk too much. So because we have limited time from Mircea, these 2-3 hours that he has at our disposal will not be enough to finish our conversation. So I immediately give him the floor. We agreed that he will not give us a 30-minute presentation, but we will have what he called a virtual fireside chat. And my first question will be, Mircea, if you permit, to tell about NATO 2030. NATO has had so many programs before. Why is NATO 2030 different?
First of all, István, thank you so much for having me. It's great to have such a global audience to our discussion. I don't know, if we age, you get less migraines or more headaches. It depends on how you treat the cycles of life. So I cherish our friendship, and you have in me and all of us here always good friends for the long haul. Also, I see on the list that your excellent ambassador here, Ambassador Nogg, I hope he's connected. If not, I'm convinced he will hear from us. Again, Hungary here is very well represented at NATO in terms of the team that Hungary has here. Listen, 72 years of history of NATO. We are described, and we like being described, as the most successful alliance in history. And I think in the end, there's a couple of ingredients to this enduring success of NATO. And among other things that are equally important, values and shared interests that connect the two sides of the Atlantic in such a successful alliance, is also the fact that we have a gene in the DNA of NATO of permanent adaptation to ever-evolving international and security environment. Many of us, including my generation, our generation, István, we believed that, in a way, after the end of the Cold War and the collapse of communism in Central Eastern Europe, we'll be witnessing, if not the end of history, at least a long cycle of predictable world order, which was the case for a number of years. But we find out again that history is not linear, that geopolitics and multiple trends can collide and coincide, giving way to a far more, let's say, agitated evolution of things. And that's NATO 2030. This is what Secretary General Stoltenberg basically has his political intention when he launched his agenda for NATO 2030, was exactly that, to challenge all of us here in NATO and in the ecosystem of NATO, in allied nations and our partners all over the world, which will be the content of our next big adaptation as an alliance. That's, in a nutshell, the political imperative behind the SecGen's proposals. There were eight of those. Also, this was also informed by the very good work that our reflection process group on NATO 2030 has provided to us, co-chaired by Thomas de Maizière and Wes Mitchell, comprised of top-level professionals and highly experienced people from a number of allied nations. So some of you might have seen the 138 propositions that they made. Of course, not all of those are part of the NATO 2030, but it was a very good background in informing us on how independent people are looking at the world as we see it. We're also very happy, and this is one of the major achievements of the NATO summit on June 14th, is that the leaders of NATO really approved the NATO 2030 agenda. All of us, and also international experts, international media, of course, they paid attention to the final communique, which I would say that this is probably one of the most commented upon final communiques I've seen in my lifetime. Not only NATO, but in many international organizations and many multi-level organizations. This was, in a way, that the interest of the media and the interest of the professional international community, including some reactions from other capitals around the world to this communique, is a sign that we are on the right track. Because if you don't trigger interest and reactions and counter-reactions, it means that you're just not doing the right thing. But it's not only the final communique that our leaders have adopted, which is a public document, of course, the final communique, but also they adopted the NATO 2030 agenda. So today, NATO 2030 is work in progress. What does it mean, work in progress? It means that from the NATO 2030 agenda, the propositions that are coming to resilience, that are coming to security implications of climate change, which is a new kid in town, the issues related to cyber defense policy adopted by our leaders, things related to partnerships of NATO, things related to common funding in NATO, things related to NATO-EU, things related to the new or the next strategic concept of NATO. All these things are today, after the summit decisions by our leaders, strands of work in NATO that are supposed to be delivered officially at the Madrid summit in 2022. So NATO 2030 is, in essence, the effort of adapting NATO to a fundamentally changed international system and realities. It's the reaction of NATO to the much broader definition of security that the pandemic has only amplified and broadened even more. And it's in its, let's say, more sublimate format, is the fact that after 2010, when we had our last strategic concept adopted in Lisbon at the summit, we'll have a new next strategic concept in Madrid next year. So that's what NATO 2030 is, in political sense, is adaptation of NATO to a change international landscape, to a change definition of security. And I have to mention also new technologies, because that's another strand of work that I'm also in charge of. I'm chairing the innovation board in NATO on behalf of the SecGen. So also new technologies, what do you call them, emerging disruptive technologies in our jargon, is also another big issues that is coming from that. So Ishvan, that's in a nutshell. I can go on and on, but this is not, the, I think, important for our discussion today, is that NATO has embarked on a new process of adaptation to a changing world. That's all. That's something that we did before successfully. I'm convinced we'll do it again successfully for the decade to come and many decades to come after that.
Thank you very much for this introduction. It was a little different from what we have heard before, much more flexible, moving target, not just we do what we thought would have been useful this year or last year, but looking forward for the next decade. And I think that will be a rolling list of things. With your permission, I would like to ask you a few questions on some concrete issues. And as we have here experts or participants who can also make a contribution, after your answer, I would ask one of those to comment on what you say quickly, because we don't have too much time, and much of the time is yours. But we will continue the discussion afterwards if you agree. So, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 50 years ago, the first question about NATO would have been Russia. But I think today it's not. My first question would be, how do we face a challenge? A challenge and an opportunity that is posed by the rise of a new superpower, China. So how do you see the role of China? And then I will ask our Chinese colleague to make a few comments on not necessarily what you say, but how he sees the role of China and the role of NATO.
Thank you, Ishvan. Listen, I'm not suggesting that NATO all of a sudden moves away from the bread and butter of what we do successfully for seven decades, which is deterrence and defense of the Euro-Atlantic area. There's no way to go outside of what we are supposed to be doing by the Washington Treaty, by the sacred obligation President Biden called the sanctity of Article 5. So NATO is not moving away from the core mission, is to protect 1 billion people from 30 nations and to be a positive factor globally in terms of the international-based order globally. But the issue is that deterrence and defense today continues to comprise more traditional threats of military nature. And Russia is a player that is continuing to pose aggressive challenges to us. And there's no need for me to start, giving examples of Russia's aggressive attitude from all directions, geographically, and in multiple domains, including in cyber, including in hybrid, including in disinformation, including in space, including in many, many ways. So Russia continues to be a challenge and a problem for NATO, and we are supposed to defend the nations in NATO against a more assertive Russia internationally. Having said that, we are, and I am, encouraging the return of Russia to the NATO-Russia Council, because we should remember that we have a dual-track approach to Russia, which is a constant policy of this alliance. Deterrence and defense on the one side, and dialogue on the other side. So I think I've made three or four propositions officially on behalf of NATO at my level to our Russian counterparts. We still hope that they will be returning also to the dialogue part while taking active measures of deterrence and defense. There's no need for us to get into those kind of details. But having said, spoken about 360 degrees geographical deterrence and defense for NATO, there are also other things in the world that really are shifting the global balance of power. And the rise of China is probably the most consequential transformation in world affairs in centuries. For the first time, we have a competitor that could be or is trying to basically capture commanding heights at global level. So when we speak about China as challenges and opportunities, we mean that. And the common language that our leaders have agreed at the NATO summit on China, that triggered some reactions in Beijing. And we're anticipating that. It's just a reflection of a mutation in global balance of power. NATO is not in the business of going to the Asia-Pacific. We're not becoming a global alliance per se. We are a regional Euro-Atlantic organization. But if the definition of security is broadening, also the rise of China is posing also challenges. China is coming closer to us. We're not going to Asia. China is coming towards Europe, towards Africa, towards Euro-Atlantic space. And again, how to find the right balance between opportunities and challenges, this is what is political leadership is all about. So let me be very clear before I understand you want to give the floor to one of the Chinese participants. NATO is not in the logic of confrontation with China. We are not seeking a new Cold War with China. This is not what we have in mind. Just the opposite. And I think for us in Central Eastern Europe, we know that one Cold War is enough for us not to go down that track. But the rise of China as a military superpower, the kind of massive buildup of their military capabilities, the fact that they are having significant developments when it comes to security and capabilities and strategic arsenals, this is something that has to be taken into account. We do hope that China, with its rising profile as a global superpower, would also understand that with more influence, also, you have more responsibilities to fill in. So this is where we make an appeal to China to basically play by the rules of the game. And as China has done on climate change, that's a subject of cooperation and dialogue. I'm convinced that on new technologies, there are things to be discussed about space, about cyber, where China and Russia and others are not always playing by the book, just the opposite. So that's the balance I think we have found at our NATO summit when it comes to China and to Russia. So I think it's nothing surprising in what our leaders have decided.
I think it would be just fair to give 2-3 minutes, if I may, to Mr. Wang, who is the representative, I'm not saying of China, because he is not the Prime Minister of China, but he is a professor at one of the best universities of China and one of the best universities of the world, a very well-known professor. And as you have answered my second question as well, without having to ask them, I would also ask Mr. Trenin to give 2 minutes on his reaction. I have to limit because we want to hear you first, but afterwards we will continue and we can have a bigger discussion. And I already want to issue a threat to both Mr. Wang and to Mr. Trenin that we want to have a similar conversation where they would sit in your chair, being the one who is giving the presentation. So we will have ample opportunities to discuss. So, Mr. Wang, very welcome, our first Chinese representative. I must add that I have a very special relationship to China because my son is a businessman and we are doing very successful business in China. So I think we know China a little bit more from our experience, and I'm very much hoping that the progress made by China will bring us together, because we have no other choice. But if you could give us a few words about your views.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation. I'm, of course, not a Chinese representative. I'm just a Chinese participant, represents my own view, not any official or other people's view. China still have some problems with NATO, understandable NATO, not just because of the historic barrels, bombing of embassy in Belgrade that people still mentioned. People still think about NATO is more of works not for Europe, basically for U.S. Strategic interests or goals. So that reason, the recent summit put China as a systematic challenge. European Union put China as a systematic rival, or U.S. Similar. The Chinese government will be confused. You think about NATO is adapting to the new environment, is thinking the new identity, but why you make a quick conclusion that China is a systematic rival, systematic challenge. Secondly, China and NATO actually share, People's Republic of China, same age of NATO, and NATO adapt to the new environment. This is also Chinese civilization adapt to the new environment. And China and NATO, I think, share the common understanding that NATO's constitution mentioned very clearly that under the UN chapter, and China always support a UN-centric international order. So even China signed more than 500 international treaties, which more than the United States does. So we think about so-called the rules-based international order, the rules, of course, the UN and international law, that's the rules, not any regional organization or alliance to set the rules. So China definitely support that kind of rule-based international order. We can have more dialogue under the United Nations framework. And thirdly, I think you mentioned about we don't need another Cold War, definitely. Cold War is benefited nobody, including not to the United States. I think we hope as a reason China put forward the Committee of Shared Future for Humankind. I think that we should distinguish two challenges. One, the Deputy Secretary General mentioned about China. Another one is the new technology, like AI or some semantic challenges like climate change. So NATO's challenges or security risks, to what extent is because of the new world, of the new technology, or new environment, not because of China, but some politicians just put China as a scapegoat of the new uncertainties. So how can make the differences between these two kinds of challenges? For the easy answer, China is rising, but the technology innovation and the climate change and uncertain world, like a pandemic, this is people not easy to understand. So how can put China as a partner, work together to solve this problem, or blame China as the as a risk of security challenges? How to manage this? Even about the NATO, you asked the NATO members to increase the military budget to 2.2% of the GDP. Actually, China is only 1.3% of the GDP, so even less than the NATO's requirement. So it's a long way to go for China to be the superpower. We don't think China still think about, according to the United Nations, developing countries, no one be the superpower. So we can actually go beyond the traditional obstacles and ideology disputes to seek our common grounds, including the cooperation with the Belt and Road Initiative, SCO, with NATO. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dmitry Tanin has been a voice of reason from Moscow for decades. I hope you remain a voice of reason, Dmitry. Could you give us a short reaction? As again, we know that you are not the Russian government, unfortunately, I mean, your views are always interesting, heard and listened to. Please, Dmitry. I don't hear you, sorry.
All right. István, thank you very much for this invitation. It's great to see you again and to be your guest. A couple of very short points. My first point is that history teaches that after each major conflict in Europe, a world order that would last would have to be built on bringing in the defeated power into the equation on the terms acceptable to that defeated power. The Cold War was such a conflict. And I think that the problem of the roots of the confrontation that we're witnessing now lie in the fact that Russia was not included in the post-Cold War order on the terms that it would find acceptable. Again, we may disagree about what's acceptable, what's not acceptable. I'm taking, let's say, a more objective or objectivist view. If you look back at the Napoleonic Wars, France was brought in 3 years, I think, after Waterloo. You think about West Germany being integrated into the NATO alliance, into the Western alliance, a few years after after the defeat of Hitler. And then you have the example of Germany post-Versailles and Russia in the 90s and later. So I think that's the problem. That's when you talk about predictable world order, you have to factor in the acceptance or lack of acceptance by the defeated power in the new order. I know that many people in Russia would dispute Russia's defeat in the Cold War, but having been a Cold Warrior myself, I can tell defeat from victory. My second point is about the dialogue between Russia and NATO. I don't think there's any room for dialogue at this point. However, I think that NATO-Russia relations would be hugely helped, and I think that security in Europe would be hugely helped if Russia and NATO could establish and expand contacts between them that would prevent incidents from happening, prevent incidents from escalating, reduce misunderstandings about each other's moves, avoid miscalculation, the misperception, and above all, avoid provoking each other. I think that one needs to take a distinction between a political position and actions by the military. For example, not recognizing Crimea as part of Russia is a political position that will not change for decades, in my view. However, challenging Russia's position in and around Crimea is fraught with very clear dangers, dangers to us all. And my last point is that it's not the new Cold War that we're going through. Again, as a veteran of the one and only Cold War, you can tell the difference. But there's no use pretending that we're not in a confrontation, a very real confrontation that is only growing in intensity. And managing that confrontation should be the task of both NATO and Russia, the United States and Russia. So let me stop here.
Okay. Mircea, even if it is stretching your patience a little bit, I cannot resist giving a minute to Andrei Stanikov. When we talk about Russia, I think our Belarusian participant must have a minute or two to make a comment.
Thank you. Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you, Justin, for organizing this and for inviting me. I also have a privilege to know Mircea for a long time, and I'm very grateful for his unwavering support for democracy in Belarus, for human rights as foreign minister, as senator, as speaker of the Senate. Thank you very much. Yeah, I think today we have an apparent crisis in Belarus, and I would like to ask a question: what is the NATO view? Because this is a local crisis, maybe, but it affects and it might have global consequences, because it also affects not only the lives of every Belarusian today, but also interest of Europeans and the interest of Russia and China. First of all, trade and economic interest, and the security interest. And that is why I would like to ask the question, if possible, is NATO observing this crisis, especially the crisis with migrants? Because NATO played a very constructive role in 2017. During the major Zapad 17 exercises, and we're approaching major Zapad 2021 exercises. Why I say they played constructive role? Because the assessment of NATO was that exercise was offensive and global in nature, not local. Because the war in Syria, war in Ukraine, maneuvers in the Baltic Sea of a nuclear fleet did show that the preparations were quite dangerous. And I think that the intellectual input of NATO in the assessment of the situation with Zapad 17 was great. And my second question, if I may, NATO and Ukraine. Now there is more talk about Ukraine wish to join NATO. What is the assessment of Deputy Secretary General about this? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now we are going back to our main guest with some questions, but I want to complicate your life a little bit more, Mircea, and ask you a question which is not a follow-up to the former one, but you yourself mentioned, and Mr. Wang mentioned also, that new technologies are posing a special challenge to us and to NATO. Unfortunately, they are not making the world more stable. So what is your assessment? What can we do? What can NATO do to limit the threat that these new technologies pose, and maybe turn it into an opportunity for more stability?
Okay, thank you for this global tour de force. I fully respect the views expressed personally or semi-institutionally by some. And that's I think, the beauty of such a dialogue. Listen, NATO's approach towards China is very recent. The first mention in a NATO official document of China is from December 2019, when our leaders met in London. And that was a paragraph that I know that our Chinese colleagues are, have looked into quite carefully, because that's official language of NATO. And we speak about this challenge and opportunities balancing approach. Even before NATO, the European Union has described China. Also, European Union is an entity that is part of the same democratic system like NATO is, but of course is a different organization. And as you remember, and I'm convinced that in Beijing, and the distinguished professor is fully aware of the fact that the European Union, before NATO, they described China as a potential partner, as a challenge, and also a systemic rival, which I think is even more direct in terms of language than systemic challenge, like we have used the word in our communique. So what I'm saying are basically is twofold. You cannot be a responsible global partner in a menu a la carte. What you like and is serving your interest, the rules, international norms are fine. When something that they don't fit you, they don't. And there's a lot of things that China's rise is creating such a challenge, such a dilemma. And some of those things are related to the values that we are discussing. I'm not saying that is every country's sovereign right to decide what kind of system they want to have domestically, But for me, coming from former communist Romania, China and Russia, for that matter, they're closer to authoritarian regimes than to democratic nations. So that's a challenge. It is a challenge because it's a systemic challenge, yes, because they promote, and China first and foremost, a different model of organizing societies. István mentioned about new technologies. I really rather prefer to live in a part of the world where the internet is free and not under censorship, like it is in China, and now Russia is trying to build something similar. What I meant about a la carte, there are issues that China is portraying itself, and I understand why, as a developing nation, while in many of the, including defense-related, security-related, military buildup, even with 1.3%, if that is the figure, that's a lot of defense investment. So, to be honest, I would strongly encourage for China to join the strategic conversations that are taking place now mainly between US and Russia, sometimes NATO and Russia. And I think a responsible global player is also entering such discussions on arms control and disarmament, including on nuclear balance at global level. We also need new rules that need to be forged together. I agree with the professor that some norms have to be UN-related in order to be global. And I'm not saying NATO is not setting any international law. We are setting, at best, standards of behavior, like we are now doing with our new AI strategy, where we are introducing for the first time, and for, I think, the first organization in the world, ethical principles for the use or non-use of AI for defense and security purposes. So you cannot have it both ways. That's what I'm saying in a nutshell. And this is not a criticism. It's just a reality. And I believe that dialogue is important. I believe that consultation is very, very good. And by no means, I do not share the view that anyone in the U.S. or in the alliance, we are seeing China as a scapegoat, as you mentioned, for other issues. No, it's great power rivalry. With all the Dmitry Trenin made the historical reference to the Napoleon War and the whole thing. And there is a shifting balance of power, and we need to find the best ways to cooperate and not go in a wrong direction. Now, of course, we can discuss about what happened after 1990, Dmitry, and was Soviet Union a defeated nation in the Cold War? Some people might argue that yes, it lost the competition with the West, with America and the West, and with NATO. Others might argue, I don't know which is the answer, to be honest. It's a subject that should be debated by more professional people than I am on this kind of things. That it was basically an implosion of a system that was not functioning anymore. This is counterintuitive, counterfactual, historical thing. I'm not in the business of doing this. I don't know. I know there were hesitations in Washington in the early 90s about the enlargement of NATO, because I was working for my country as an ambassador, trying to convince the U.S. to enlarge NATO. So this is a conversation that I believe it's interesting, but I also do not share the view that being aggressive and assertive is the way forward, I mean, on behalf of Russia. When you spoke about Crimea, that's interesting because you say in and around Crimea, we are talking about in and around Ukraine. Why do you need, as Russia, that sudden military buildup a few months ago in and around Ukraine and around Crimea? Is it the utilization of a Crimean peninsula as a projection of power towards the Middle East and to the Mediterranean, something which is constructive and meaningful, could be from a Russian interest? Something that I will never be able to accept as a citizen, not speaking of my NATO position, is that legitimate national security interests of countries, they are legitimate because that's how that country sees its own security. This is something that I'm always ready to accept and to respect. an analysis based on facts, on threats and opportunities, and then each nation, in case in point, the Russian Federation, can establish their own, let's say, definition of legitimate national security interests. What I'm not in the position to accept, and I cannot accept also morally and politically and strategically, is that that right should be used as a pretext to impose on your neighbors conflict, secessionist wars, and a direction that they do not want to go into. This is something that I have a difficulty of. I know that in Russia many people consider the color revolutions, that's the term, as something that was fomented by the West. I know this kind of thing. But I do not say that, I do not believe that when it comes to, open doors and Ukraine or Georgia, is up to Russia to dictate the destiny of these neighbors of hers. I don't think this is something that's acceptable as norms of behavior. But I fully agree that dialogue is needed. Of course, in order to avoid misunderstandings and inadverted risks, because there are many, many incidents that do happen. That's a flurry of interactions between NATO and Russia in the high north, in the Barents Sea, in the Baltic Sea, in the Black Sea, in the Mediterranean Sea. And I think this should be addressed in a way that will be constructive and not really lead towards, God forbid, incidents or escalation. But what I'm saying is that we just cannot separate the mill-to-mill discussion from some form of political dialogue. What President Biden has done with President Putin in Geneva. They also have set some real red lines on both sides, I understand, from nuclear arms control to cyber and to many other things. I do believe that NATO and Russia should also re-engage, and Russia should re-engage with us. There was a question from our friend from Belarus about Zapad. We just finished a massive NATO exercise, Steadfast Defender, just a few weeks ago. It was a massive exercise of NATO. We are ready to share the lessons learned and everything that is to be shared with Russia when it comes to Zapad. There will be a new one now in the fall. So I think that some form of political dialogue is also needed, while, of course, each side continues to defend their interest and act accordingly. Now, when it comes to Belarus, the position of NATO has been very, very clearly stated. Speaking of democracy, I think nobody can, at least in the democratic world, ever agree with the idea that legitimate opposition exprimation is something which becomes illegal and leads to arrests and this kind of brutal repression of legitimate opposition. This is something that, of course, we cannot agree. And, of course, this is not NATO. And also, I read the news reports. The fact that NATO is used as a pretext for domestic actions or Russia, Belarus, even closer ties, this is just not true. NATO is not in the business. We are doing nothing when it comes to being a threat to anybody. We are a defensive organization. We have put some NATO troops and some forward presence in the Baltics and in the Black Sea after the illegal annexation of Crimea. There was no intention from NATO to go in that direction. We are just reacting defensively to a situation which is of concern. And I just cannot applaud the courage of the opposition in Belarus, even if sometimes they suffer significant pressures, or some of them are in the position to basically find refuge in more friendly countries.
One more quick question, if you agree. As you are a historic person in the history of NATO, as one the highest ranking official from the what we used to call new members, which are not so new anymore, there is another historic person with us, Ambassador Wirtz Cilla, who was the first female secretary of the North Atlantic Council. So with your permission, she would have a short question if you agree. Cilla, please.
Thank you very much, István, and thank you for inviting me. And let me at the outset greet the Deputy Secretary General and say that this is my honor to share the screen with you, sir. My question will refer to Para 60 and 61 of the summit communique, which focus on human security and the women, peace and security agenda. It was also mentioned that allies at the summit agreed to take a more global approach in the sense to cooperate more widely with like-minded countries across the globe and partner nations as well as international organizations. So my question is, what concrete steps you foresee in this regard, and specifically on the women, peace and security agenda and on human security, taking into consideration the recommendations of the reflection group? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the question. A pleasure to share the screen with you and all of you. Listen, I mentioned at the beginning of my short introduction that the definition of security is becoming broader. And there is, in this discussion about a very broad definition of security, not only the relatively new issues of resilience, of new technologies, of space, but also the dimensions of human security, of women, peace and security, and also something that was reflected actively in the final communique, also the security implications of climate change. So if I would refer to these last two, human security and women, peace and security, which is not the same, in our understanding, is not the same thing. They overlap, but human security has a certain breadth, and human peace and security is an indispensable set of policy that, speaking of the UN, is basically a UN Security Council resolution that basically informed and in a way led the massive transformation in NATO on this topic. So I think we have to do even more. We have to do even more, both on human security. When we speak about doing more with and for our partners, I'm not mentioning only the partners that are, let's say, rich, highly competitive nations, like we have the four Asia-Pacific partners, like we have with the Western European partners of ours, like Austria or Sweden or Finland or Ireland, but also many countries that are in a situation of intense fragility, and mainly the countries to our south. So I think we have to find together the instruments, and women, peace and security is one of the tools that I believe is probably one of the most important ones that we have to need to put in work in making sure that we help these countries. We can help them in many ways when it comes to NATO, defense capacity building, building integrity, women, peace and security. And I don't share a secret that Tunisia, for that matter, offered to host a regional center on women, peace and security with our help. And I think this is something we should respond positively to. Jordan, which is an enhanced opportunity partner together with Ukraine and Georgia, has just launched. I was really privileged to share the screen with them, launching with our help and allied help a regional training center for women in the military. And there will be hundreds and thousands of women in uniform, in various positions, that will be getting this kind of support. I was so proud, really so proud, when the UN approached us 2 years ago, I think, and we were able to respond positively to a request from the UN for NATO to help the UN training for peacekeepers for the UN. Not in terms for NATO to train the peacekeepers of the UN. UN has to do that. But also to give to the UN the kind of analytical and benchmarking things, including on women, peace and security, that we use for the training that we do in NATO, and we are doing these things very, very well. I'm giving you this example. I'm very passionate about this topic, because if we stay very limited, very narrow in our definition of security, I think we'll not be able to cope neither with the traditional threats that I refer to, nor with the more novel threats of that sort. So Secretary General Stoltenberg himself is a huge promoter of the program, has a special representative of the SecGen. Claire Hutchison, our colleague, Ambassador Hutchison, she just finished her tenure with us. We'll have a new colleague taking over. So human security and women, peace and security are massive priorities for us in NATO. And thank you for the question. It's a very relevant one. Ishvan, I forgot to answer your question about EDTs and rules based order. Yes, I believe this is a topic that could and should be an incentive for all nations around the world, including rivals, systemic or not systemic, to try to have a predictable international set of norms for the new technologies which are here with us. Most of them are unregulated in terms of sanctioning of international norms, and the UN is the logical place to do that. So we call on all nations to really be there, and we are working with the UN on these things. We are working with the OECD in terms of understanding better the complexity of new technologies. The EU is doing formidable work in that direction. So I do. Look at the way in which space, outer space, is today regulated in terms of international norms. They are antiquated norms from a few decades ago. And look, China, that's legitimate attempt from China to become also a superpower also in space. That's something that is part of the global competition and human ingenuity. Nothing wrong with that. But look to the congestion in space. Thousands and thousands of satellites, now low orbit, now international tourism is starting, as I've seen in the news yesterday. So we have to find ways for us to make sure that we deconflict and we create predictable norms also for the outer space. Cyber is the most complicated things that we have in front of us. Even today we are speaking about state and non-state actors basically creating disruptions and uncertainties that are very dangerous. All of us need, including countries that do not share our values, to create a norm, a system of norms that are creating some predictability. And then the business of Ishvan's son in China will be more protected and more successful. I'm joking now.
Well, I hope you will not. I know that your time is limited and we have already over the time that your colleagues have promised, but we all know that our colleagues are always more restrictive than we are. So I'm grateful that you have given this much time, and I just ask you for a few more minutes because we have here somebody who is very well known in many parts of the world for her analytical mind. So I asked Ambassador Semir Kényi, Reka indeed, is a better name for her, to kind of give a, what do you bring, Reka, home in Washington, home from this conversation?
Well, thank you. Thank you, Ishvan, and thank you, Deputy Secretary General, for this fantastic discussion. It's really an honor to be here with you. As Chila said, and I think there's a lot of takeaway from this discussion. It was a fantastic virtual fireside chat that we could enjoy with you, and we very much appreciate your directness, straightforwardness, and very much insightful points. There's a lot of takeaway, and I think there's a lot that has been sort of raised in the discussion by you. Primarily, it is very encouraging to see that the real goal of launching NATO 2030 is to respond to the challenges ahead of us is on its way already. So we are already in the process of not just thinking about it, but it's a work in progress, as you said, to adapt the organization and the cooperation inside to the new definition of security that we are facing, including also, of course, the new technologies, as you said, the emerging disruptive technologies, but at the same time, not moving away from deterrence and defense. I think those have been two of the very important messages. As a very important discussion point that is an important takeaway is about Russia, that it can, how it continues to pose aggressive challenges from all directions and in multiple domains to the organization, and how important it is to focus on increasing dialogue, restarting dialogue, and intensifying the discussion in the strategic challenges without giving up the values and the strength of the coherence of the organization. Another very important takeaway related to the challenge, the systemic challenge that is posed by China. And it was also very important to listen to your analysis about NATO, which is not in the logic of confrontation with China, just the very opposite. But as in order to be a respected and cooperative partner, China has to take both all aspects of the international order and cannot make an a la carte partner in the international cooperation. So if underlining the balancing approach between challenges and opportunities that NATO has been taking and NATO sets itself to take. As a last thought, I think what is very important to me from our discussion is that in it was very reinforcing to us to see that NATO has a very crucial role and continues to play this role by and through the process of NATO 2030. Of setting best practices, strengthening the value system that we have been seeing to ensure peace and stability in the world, and keeping the internal conversation and engaging in dialogue with partners and with challengers in the future as well. So if I may say the one last thought that I would that struck in me is that in addition to defense and deterrence, which have been NATO's fundamental goals, probably from your discussion, we could add dialogue. Strategic and intensive dialogue as a third D to our understanding of the challenges and missions. So thank you very much for this discussion and very good to have this opportunity.
Thank you very much. Thanks, first of all, Deputy Secretary General Joanna, for giving us this opportunity and for everybody who participated. I'm sorry that not everybody had the chance to talk, but this is the nature of these meetings. We will come back to most of you one way or another for a continuation of this discussion. And I hope that that you have enjoyed it, that I have learned a lot. I take home what Reka suggested to take home, and I hope, Mircea, that you will count on our support. I'm sure you know you can. And thanks very much for everybody for being with us. Enjoy the rest of the day. Remain in an air-conditioned room because it's extremely hot, especially in Hungary, but in some other countries, I'm sure, too. And I hope to see you and to talk to you very soon, one way or another. Thanks very much and all the best.